Pizza.
Okay, so let's call to order the regular meeting and public hearing of the North Bend Planning Commission for Thursday, October 13th, 2016. First, I'd like to just introduce our city staff, our Community Economic Development Director, Jenna Estep, and our Senior Planner, Mike McCarty, who are joining us this evening. The purpose of the legislative meeting is to discuss the proposed amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 18.10.030 and 18.10.050 concerning the RV parks in the IC zone, as well as 14.12 floodplain management with minor amendments to 14.05 and 14.08. We will begin with a public hearing regarding the Snoqualmie Valley Athletic Center. Just a reminder, if you're wishing to speak, to go ahead and sign up, and we welcome any verbal or written comments. Yeah, I'm going to get there. Just want to remind everybody that the meeting is being recorded, and the audio as well as the minutes will be available on the city's website. Once we make our recommendation, whether we make it tonight or at a future meeting, this and all items move to the City Council, where you have another opportunity to speak and submit public comment. If we do not make a recommendation, the City Council can take action without our recommendation as well. Okay. With that, I'll entertain a motion to approve the minutes.
I'll second that.
So, motion by Commissioner Lucky, second by Commissioner Ryan. Any comments or changes? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Minutes are approved. Next item on the agenda is public comment on non-agenda items. Is there anyone here who wishes to speak to the commission on something that is not on the agenda? All right. Seeing none, we'll move to our public hearing on the development agreement with Snoqualmie Valley Athletic Association for Snoqualmie Valley Athletic Center.
Mr. Chair.
One second. Before we get into the commission, I would like to know if the staff would like to give us and the community just a brief update and introduction to the item.
Okay, well, I'll give just kind of a project overview. Talk a little bit about what a development agreement is and why we're here and the process related to it. Then there'll be some discussion on the planning commission and deliberation possibly. So basically, our North Bend Municipal Code allows people who have ownership and property to enter into a development agreement with the city subject to a process, and that process includes it's a public process, and the decision makers are the city council. It starts with the planning commission, and the planning commission holds public hearing, which is why you are all here. They hear the testimony that you are going to provide. They evaluate the information that was provided to them from the applicant and responded to by staff. And then the Planning Commission ultimately makes a recommendation to City Council. And then City Council takes all that information into consideration and can build on the file and the testimony if more comes to light. And then ultimately makes a decision. So, The purpose of a development agreement allows the city and the applicant to address sometimes specific items or issues that may need a certain additional review or look or an adjustment of some sort, but it does not allow an applicant in any way, shape, or form to not meet the provisions of the code. It does allow some flexibility in, but the intent of the code has to remain intact. Anyway, the applicant, what we have today is we have a development agreement by Bendigo Properties, LLC, for an athletic facility. And the proposed athletic facility does include four combination soccer and baseball fields, and then a indoor athletic facility. The proposal is, and the original reason for the development agreement actually was because the proposal was to construct this facility in two phases. The first phase would include fields and the associated improvements along with those fields, like the parking and lighting is proposed. But it did not include, with the first phase, the typically normal requirement of sewer. The sewer is an expensive improvement because the fact it needs to go from a wastewater treatment plant over the river to the site. So the actual development as a whole is what starts making that a feasible endeavor. So the applicant did propose to build this in two phases in order to have the fields available. And so the development agreement started out as a means to address this issue. And so the development agreement does allow within the first phase the necessary sanitary sewer issues to be handled in a temporary scenario through porta potties that will be screened and what have you. And then when and if the final second phase is developed, sewer would be connected. So that was kind of the original purpose of the development agreement. As one thing about a development agreement is it is initiated prior to complete review of your municipal code. Again, being said, they're required to meet our municipal code. So these are really kind of trying to identify those issues that need to kind of be addressed outside the premise that they're going to meet the code. And including if the development agreement is ahead of dialed down or complete engineering design from the applicant and review from the city. So that being said, a development agreement in the end gives you some parameters, but it really does require full compliance of the municipal code. So that means if there are things that the city finds through the review, whether it's stormwater, boundary line accuracies, or what have you, those things become material to adjusting the actual what gets built in the ground, on the ground. Let's see here. Would you like me to go kind of through the development agreement in detail beyond that, or?
No, I don't think.
Okay.
In the interest of time, no.
Okay, I'll sum it up by, we have received a number of comments, and a lot of the comments are related to things like lighting concerns, noise concerns, traffic, you know, normal concerns that you have with any development. And keep in mind, development agreements do not allow construction to begin. It basically just sets the playing field for both parties to start engineering and design work and that kind of aspect. So, with that being said, there is still a number of, they need to get a site plan approval. They need to go through what we call the State Environmental Policy Act CEPA process, which often is where you start addressing mitigation conditions for concerns like lighting and things like that. And then ultimately, it would require an engineering approval, and then construction starts after that. So that's kind of how the process occurs. So with that, I will hand it back to you, Gary.
Okay. Before we get started with the public hearing, the commission will undergo a fairness qualification, just a couple of questions. Does anyone in the audience tonight object to my or any of the commission members' participation? If so, please state so and give the reason for the objection. Seeing none, commission members, I ask you if you have any financial or personal interest in the affected property or issue.
I have a 25-year history with bordering property, the Encompass Northwest. I feel like I have a fairness issue.
Okay. Thank you. Do you think you could consider this an affair, I guess, an objective matter, or are you saying that?
Mr. Chair, I don't think anybody in this room thinks that I would treat unfairly, but I'm just saying that as a matter of protocol, I've been around long enough, I can't see the reason to put this project in jeopardy by my taking part.
Okay. Thank you very much. Does anybody on the commission have any ex parte communication that you've had outside of this hearing with opponents or proponents of this matter? Okay. So just for the public, we have all the written comments that were sent to Planning Commission as part of the record, and that's part of our packet, as well as an additional comment 16 through 20 tonight that we got. Prior to opening up the public meeting, I have the list of everybody that signed in. Everybody on the list will be given 3 minutes to speak. Your comments should be made to the chair. Before you speak, please state your name and address for the record clearly. With that, I'll go ahead and open the public hearing at 7:25, it looks like. And just let me get my timer up here. Okay, it looks like Ruli Harris is first on the list.
What would you like?
Anywhere. You can stay there or you can come up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commission members. My name is Ruli Harris. I live at 768 Douglas Avenue, South. As a former warehouse employee, I'm delighted to see your use of the paper. I would like to just, I'm here tonight to really express my strong support. And it's really based on what I see as a significant need in the valley for this type of facility. Let me just give you two perspectives. My grandson, who is 12, has been involved in pretty much every sport that the valley offers over the last 7 or 8 years. He's been at the Saviu Rec League, Basketball Rec League, the Falls League, and All-Stars, the Junior Wildcat football program, and the Junior Select basketball program. Runs out of my side. And I have seen over those years the twists and turns and problems and cancellations and everything you can imagine to try to get practices and games in both baseball and basketball and football. So adding this to the mix of what we can offer our kids in the valley, I think is a significant step in the right direction, and I urge your support for that reason. The other aspect of the need that I see for the facility is I have been working for the Snoqualmie Valley YMCA for the almost 5 years that we've been open. And I know firsthand from that perspective that we get probably one call a week asking if somebody can rent our gym. Unfortunately, we don't have the ability to do that because it's pretty much full-time with Y programs. So, bottom line, I think there's a very strong need for this complex, and I urge your support, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. Okay, next person on the list is Chris Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be here tonight. Chris Hoffman, I'm at 7447 Raven Avenue Southeast in Snoqualmie. Two things that I would say. First of all, I would just second Rolly's comments this evening. I feel there's a need. His perspective, even understanding his position on the why, recognizes that from a different perspective than I come from. Two places for me, my two children that are involved certainly in athletics. One is in baseball and basketball, among other things. And the other one is basketball. I will say that my younger one, my children are 9 and 12. My youngest, thankfully, also has an interest in music. By the time he gets to the point where he might use this athletic facility, he may not be interested in it because he has other interests and passions. And in speaking to that, it is simply why I'm here today to say this gives an opportunity to expand the use to a larger, wider audience of kids that may not be able to be involved. And I say that because for 16 years, I was a coach for a King Cove school, and I was also an athletic director. To Rolly's point earlier, I was contacted constantly about field use and certainly about gym use. I didn't have enough room for my own kids in the program that I worked at. We had to cut programs just to keep, limit the participation because we didn't have enough space. I understand in speaking with, and I shouldn't speak for the district, but I know that they may have a need as well if you were to reach out to them to be able to use a facility and expand their programs to even more kids. As I pointed out with regard to my son enjoying music, we know for a fact that when kids are involved in activities, they do better in school. They usually have less issues at home. Sports provides the opportunity that a lot of kids need from other mentors as far as coaches, etc. And again, my other son, it doesn't matter what you're involved in. It doesn't matter if you're involved in band or drama or anything else, right? That gives you the opportunity to have other people involved in your life that are coaches, that are mentors, that help you along the road. This facility will expand that opportunity for more kids to be impacted by the people that volunteer their time in this community to support and raise wonderful kids to be great adults. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your comments. Next person on the list is Jen Spence.
Spence. Jennifer Spence, thank you for allowing us to speak tonight. 35128 Southeast Kinzie Street, Snoqualmie, Washington. I'm here kind of on two accounts. One is a parent that has kids in the school district in Snoqualmie Valley that play soccer, baseball, lacrosse, you name it, all the sports that they mentioned. And as parents, we constantly deal with late night practices, canceled practices, too many kids in the gym, not enough fields, bad fields. The list goes on and on and on, and this is a great opportunity, and we're fortunate to have people that are willing to build and create and add value to the community. So we're in favor of this for sure. And to echo some of Chris's points around late night practices and those types of things, I mean, as parents, you don't want your kids practicing until 10 o'clock at night. And so if we can have more facilities and get kids in and out of activities and still being able to get to bed on time and eat dinner with their parents and get their homework done, that would certainly be great. The second hat I'm wearing tonight is I am the president of the lacrosse club, and we have 19 teams and 350 players that are from North Bend to Falls City. And when it comes down to the season, it's very difficult to find field time, especially when it's, you know, dark early, it's raining, we need lights. There's just not enough access for any of our teams, youth or high school. And so we are in full support of this facility to really help with that. And frankly, we get, you know, we get pushback from other Kinko cities when we travel to Bellevue and Issaquah and the Plateau wanting better facilities, and this gives us an opportunity to bring people to our valley and have economic development as well. So again, on those two parts, we're very much in support of this project.
Thank you very much for your comments. Okay, next person on the list is Kristen Webb.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Kristen Webb. My address is 320 Southeast 10th Street in North Bend. And I am here representing Encompass, which has an adjacent property to the proposed development. We are very much in favor of this development and looking forward to our new neighbors and partnering with them. A concern for us is the proposed Bulge Avenue improvements, including the 5-foot wide bike lane. It's kind of unclear from looking at the plan whether that is going to continue on and go in front of our property on Bolt Street. And if it does, that could severely impact the safety. Well, we have a parking lot there, so we have cars coming in and out. So it wouldn't be safe for the bicyclists, and it would make an unsafe entrance and exit to our parking lot. Additionally, I see that there are some 14th Avenue improvements being planned as well. I don't know if that will continue on 14th Avenue past our facility and impact any of the parking that we currently have there.
Thank you for your comments.
You.
And questions or things of that nature like you posed, I'll have the staff at the end of the public kind of go through them. So if you guys have the improvement with the bike lanes and then also the 14th Avenue. Next person on the list is Dave Batty. Dave, could you state your name and address for the record?
Thank you for this opportunity. I'm David Batty, 8031 Douglas Avenue Southeast, Napalmy. I'm on the Meadowbrook Farm Board, and I'm also on the Y Board. I wrote on Livings Napalmy how I really do feel this is an exceptionally good plan simply because you have a 460-acre Meadowbrook farm right across the creek. You have all of that Yak Boy Scout property right across Balch. And for the youth, we're just kind of tying things together, and I think that's great. What I want to talk about is mitigation, perhaps things that can't be mitigated as far as we, the cities and us, we have funded a planner to look at the future of Meadowbrook Farm, how to make it more efficient for the public, and how to make it more efficient financially. Our money generally comes, primarily comes from West. I honestly don't believe, and they're usually Saturday and Sunday, and I just do not believe that folks are going to want to have a wedding with screaming sports going on right across the creek. So I'm not saying that, I'm just saying that it's parking and lots of things can be mitigated. This one can't. The end result is that the income, the earned income for Meadowbrook Farm is going to be at risk, and the cities or someone is going to have to address this.
Thank you for your comments. Next person on the list is it Mary Naughton, Meadowbrook? How do you say your last name?
Norton.
Norton. Okay. Sorry about that, Mary.
Thank you for the chance to comment. My name is Mary Norton. I live at 41502 Reinig Road in Snoqualmie. And I'm here also wearing two hats. I've been on the Snoqualmie Park Board. I'm not presently on it, but I've been on it for about 25 years through the planning process of the bridge. And as hard as we worked on that, we really have a field deficit in the valley. So I'm glad to see this project come forward to bring some more field and athletic opportunities to the valley, because that's a deficit that was very clear in Snoqualmie's planning process, and as ECHO did their comp plan. And I think this will be a real asset to the valley. My other hat is with Dave and Tim on the Meadowbrook Farm Board. And as a park property jointly owned by the two cities, it's been very minimally funded and supported by the two cities financially, and is mostly run by volunteers. And I share Dave's concerns with this project as affecting the financial status. The cities have just participated with us in a business plan that's been very clear that rental of the building is the primary money that funds the operation and the maintenance of the property as a park asset for the valley. And I think the close proximity of the noise and the lighting will affect that. And I'm not saying that against the project, but it's something I think the cities have to keep in mind. 90-foot light poles and lights in the evening is definitely going to affect the rental ability of the property. And for people typically have weddings out in the front yard, the noise that's next door is going to affect the desirability of that. And I think the traffic aspects of channeling all this traffic, half of them trying to make a left turn on 202, backing up into that parking lot, can't get to that parking lot, so you drop them off at Meadowbrook in the middle of a wedding, and they scurry across the lawn down the trail. All this is going to affect the marketability of what's going on there. It may well be a worthwhile trade-off, but it's something the city has to be aware of. And I would also ask that when the trail is planned, we be taken in as part of the discussion on that. And similarly with the buffer, I've heard there's buffer averaging being planned. If the buffer is extended onto the Meadowbrook site, we would ask to be part of that discussion. And I hope that there can be a wide buffer plan that takes into consideration the noise aspects that will go on at the same time wedding memorial services and other events are happening in Meadowbrook.
All right, your time is up. I thank you for your comments.
I'd like to hand in some written comments
about
parks and stuff on the parking and that sort of thing.
Thank you. Okay, the next person on the list is Wes Dover.
Thank you.
Please state your name and address for the record.
Wes Dover, 1110 Mountain View Boulevard, Southeast in North Bend. Thank you for hearing me. I am the current president of the Wildcat Baseball Booster Club, so obviously we are 100% for this plan. About a year and a half ago, when we first got word that the high school, the first thing they were going to remove was the baseball and softball field, and the last thing they were going to build was the baseball and softball field. We knew we had a problem, and we needed a place to play. So myself, Brent Lutz, and three or four other gentlemen on our board began working with the school district, working with the cities of Snoqualmie and North Bend to a certain extent as far as inquiring as to where we can play. We looked at all the fields. And like has been mentioned here, there really is a lack of 90-foot baseball field or high school baseball fields. There are a couple that would have needed extensive refurbishing to make them usable for the next 4 years. We looked at trying to do something at Torgerson. We looked up on the ridge. We even looked in Falls City. And we were very disappointed at what our options were going to be, to the point where we were thinking about how we can raise money to bus kids out of town to practice and to play, which would have been a big undertaking and a logistic nightmare. When the Miller project, this athletic project, came to our attention, you know, we were a little dumbstruck. These things just don't happen. I mean, we all know, or at least I know, the Little League just emptied their coffers to do extensive work on Torgerson. You have the soccer organization putting, I think, $1 million into new fields. Our estimations were anywhere from $500,000 to $2 million if we were going to do a good baseball field that could be played on by our varsity and our JV and even our freshmen to a certain extent. So in my mind, this is something that can't be passed up. This does not happen where a private owner comes in and says, here. And I hope that you certainly move forward with this. I'm not going to go into all the aspects of baseball and turf and the importance of that, although it is of extreme importance. In our weather in the spring, our boys most of the time are hitting wiffle balls in the gym. Or if our game is canceled, then we have to go play on someone else's artificial turf. So that was one of our main goals as a field group, or whatever you want to call us, looking for the new field, was to find a way that we can play on AstroTurf. Not just play, but practice, because that's where it really matters, is practicing. This project gives us, and softball, unlimited opportunities, and please don't pass it up. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next person on the list is Angie Metik.
Minting. Close enough. I've been called worse. My name is Angie Minting. Thank you so much, Commissioner, for allowing us to speak here today. I live at 7109 St. Andrews Lane in Snow Palming. I just have one hat. I'm a mom. We moved here 3 years ago now and just cannot leave with all of the young, amazing families that come here because of how they want to raise their children, that you are so sorely lacking in the things that we need to raise our children. I believe sports are very important in raising children to learning how to win, learning how to lose, time management, discipline, structure. They're not the only things that teach those lessons, but they teach many of those lessons to many kids. I do not want to discount what is happening or may happen to Meadowbrook Farms or to other people. There always are impacts, and I'm not saying you just have to weigh 100 families getting married versus 300 families every day using a facility like this. I'm not saying that. I do not want to sound cold. I do not want to sound callous. What I'm saying is you guys have a very difficult job of trying to weigh those things. It is very, I think, important, the fact that this is a private enterprise coming into doing this, that you are not bankrolling this. You are not part bankrolling this. This is being paid not by the public. We are not having to do this. Obviously, we're going to pay to use it. But I think it's really important that a private company is coming in and doing this. You know, I see a lot of times in my businesses, the public being asked to fund arenas, to have to, fund fields. And that is not the case here. I think that's an important distinction.
Thank you for your comments. Okay, next person on the list is Tom, can't really tell, Chapman.
Hi, my name is Tom Chapman. I am, my address is 8907 Norman Avenue Southeast in Snow Palming, 98065. I'm here tonight representing the Wildcats, Snow Valley Wildcats Junior Football and Cheerleading Association. I'm the president of that organization, representing about 250, 300 children and coaches and their families. And as a parent, I echo the sentiments of Raleigh and Chris and Jen and Angie and others who have spoken about the benefits of sports facilities and to the opportunity and the outlet that sports provide. And I'd also like to speak to the scarcity of the fields in this area and some of the condition of the fields, especially around this time of year. So the timing of this hearing couldn't be more timely, really, for, we just got out of practice. I did my best to stay clean, and I had to half undress on my way here, and I apologized. But these fields at this time of the year are extremely challenging to play in. The weather obviously gets worse as the season progresses. As much as we absolutely love Centennial Fields and all the parents love that location and the view, Meadowbrook Farms is absolutely right. It's an absolutely beautiful area there. The fields just become very hard to practice on, and the fields are just currently saturated in one practice tonight. We were hopping all over our fields to try to stay out of the mud, but as soon as we did, we were creating another mud pile in the next area. And what happens is now the fields are worse the next week and the wet next week after that, and it's just real hard to plan. So to have an opportunity like this where we can hugely upgrade our facilities and have a practice space like many of our neighboring and competitors, Skyline and East Lake and so on, and have a field where we can have the predictability of a safe turf, we'll have fewer injuries during practice, just much better facilities to practice on. And this has been a dream of the Wildcats football and cheerleading organization for many years, so to have this opportunity in front of us today is as you said, we're rather dumbstruck by the opportunity. So I'd also like to speak very briefly, if I have time left, to talk about the availability, the scarcity. And I work with the Snoqualmie Valley School District in scheduling, and we oftentimes get bumped from fields, so sometimes we're not able to practice or compete because of that. So.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. Next person on the list is Michael Davids. Davies?
Davies.
Thank you. Michael Davies, 917 Northeast 8th Street, North Bend, Washington. I'm going to differ from the rest of these guys. So I work right across the street. I'd say I'm the only person, which makes you all outnumber me highly. So I play frisbee in the field every day with my dog out there. It's fantastic. The view's fantastic. If I was into team sports, it'd be a fantastic place to play team sports. But just on my own personal stance, it's a great field. Like Meadowbrook's such a cool place. Having 202 there already, you can always hear the road, no matter how deep you get into it. Having like that much more noise, like, is a bummer because you can really get lost in the woods there. So I like that a lot. I moved here 3 years ago as well. My wife and I just bought the house. She works at Encompass. I work across the street. Planning on starting our own young family. I right now don't feel the need for all these different fields, but I understand that there is now. But my concern is the lack of green space that we're also creating at the same time. Big development on behind Silver Creek, big development behind the Grange. We're going to lose this field. Like I played sports when I was a kid. They're important to me, being able to have my own space so I can also be a child in was equally as important. And that has led me towards my engineering degree. That has led me towards the person I was, being able to have space and trees and forests and away from parents and away from everything and have my own nature. And the nature's fantastic here. It's right there. Your town's fantastic. Like, you guys have everything. But as a kid, you can't always drive out to the mountainside trailhead. Having these green spaces right in town, I think for children, is every bit as important as having enough ball fields to play in. That's my good. As well, I'm glad you're putting a bike path in. Taking the bike path all the way to the dog park, and then having to pop out on Bolts every day is kind of a bummer, so I'm appreciative of that. Light pollution's a bummer. If we can figure out some way to cut it or however many days we don't run lights, that'd be awesome. The intersection at Bolt and 202 is already heinous. It's super dangerous every day of five. You have to shoot the gap. Cars are whipping by at 55. That's a bummer. And then when you just add, when we had 14th close, and thank you for fixing 14th, that was seriously bad. Even just having that little road closed, there was between 4:30 and 6, there was like 8 cars piled up trying to get through that one intersection. So having more entrances on the Bulge, I'm not sure if that's what this is signifying, but like any more traffic on that road and that intersection is going to get way more dangerous. I would just like to say green space, I imagine this would be a fantastic thing. I'm just concerned about all the development. I think individually, they're doing decent-sized projects, but on a large scale. When I was moving here, I looked at it on a map, and I was like, oh, wow, that's a nice small town, and I measured it, and it was like a quarter mile from one end of town to the other. I was like, that's the town I want to live in. That is awesome. I don't want to just see our bounds pushed. I don't want to see that much more traffic. Like, I don't know. This is good. Okay. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Okay, looks like we have two more speakers left on the list. Wendy Miller.
Hi. Wendy Miller. I live at 6814 Denny Peak Drive, Southeast, Small Pony, 8065. My husband and I are the developers of this project. We've been talking with Jenna and Mike for probably 2.5 years now on this project, getting feedback. We've talked to many of the people that you see in this room and beyond, folks from Encompass. We talked to them for many, many years about what our plans are, what our thoughts are, and how we can, really upgrade the area, bring people to the city, and not all the time, but really provide an amenity to the entire valley, not just North Bend and Snoqualmie, but for everybody to have something to play on. Bring some economic development to the city as well. I mean, we're getting ready to build two hotels. Well, who's going to stay in those hotels? So you know, we looked at this as something for not just our children, which we have five of them that would want to play here and participate in things here, but also for all of our friends, all of the community to come and play in, and a safe place to do. There are a lot of concerns that I heard tonight, and we want to address all those things. We welcome all of the feedback. We welcome the concerns. We want to work with our neighbors. We live in this community. So we're not just some big developer that's walking in here and we're going to mess up everything and then walk away. We live here. We're going to stay here forever. John's owned this land for 12 years now. We're going to hopefully own it for 50 more. You know, when it comes to weddings and you know, being able to use Meadowbrook, you know, we don't want to disturb that. We hope that, you know, by bringing the sewer out to that area, that, you know, it, you guys can actually enhance some of the weddings and some of the things, services that you can provide at Meadowbrook by providing a sewer there. You know, when it comes to noise, I mean, we'll work with the city, we'll work with Meadowbrook. We have to do some mitigation. You know, we welcome those ideas and what we can do. When we talk about parking for Encompass, you know, it's a very large facility, and for the most part, it's not being used during the day at all, Monday through Friday. We've approached Encompass on numerous occasions and said, use our parking lot, please. You know, park your cars there, have your families park there, your teachers can park there, whatever. We're not using it during the day. You know, in the evening, it's a little bit different story. When you talk about green space, we do like green space. Unfortunately, you know, sometimes green space has to, you know, be utilized in a different way. You know, the majority of the area is still open and it can still be run on and kids can still play on it. And we have this beautiful 460-acre park that's right next door, and the Boy Scouts are across the street. You can use that area as well, but 3 seconds. So from all of us that have been participating in this project, we want to let the community know that we are part of the community and we're here to enhance the community and work with the community to make this a great project that everybody can use. So thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Last person on the list is Chris Kovach.
My name is Chris Kovach, 2255 Squawk Mountain Loop, Issaquah, Washington. Just so everybody knows, I'm the civil engineer for the project, so Don and Wendy pay me to help them with this. But to give you a little bit of perspective about where I come from for something like this, so my kids are in high school now, but you know, 15 plus years ago, they were little guys, and I was coaching soccer and baseball, and we go through a lot of laundry detergent as we come home in the mud. And when I was in high school, on Thanksgiving Day, my friends and I used to go play mud football, and that was really fun and cool. And then later on, as a civil engineer, I did one of my first projects for a parks department, and they explained to me, you know, when kids do that, I can put a field out of commission in this area for 18 months and just ruin it. And we happened to be working on the first field turf project that I worked on. And I started learning about that. And this was 15 years ago. So natural grass is obviously much preferred to everybody, but you cannot play on it. You would need 50 fields and use up land that way to support the demand for all these kids and all the different activities. And so I've started working on a lot of these turf field projects, and I think they really are a tremendous benefit to the communities. If you look at what Don and Wendy have proposed, so for baseball, configured for different ages, from little league to high school baseball, high school softball, lacrosse, men's and women's, there'll be tick marks, I think, is in the plan for football, so, and then two soccer fields. So you have tremendous flexibility for just a broad spectrum of kids. Then you go indoor, so you have the courts. I really hear your concerns, because I also live right next to a green space in Issaquah, and I recognize yours. In particular, I'm on the board of the Friends of Lake Sammamish State Park, so we have a similar, beautiful, almost same acreage area that we're trying to protect and preserve in a similar way. What's important to recognize here is that this is not just some come in and pave it over development team. The community emphasis has been apparent since day one, since they started talking to me about it. and that's made me just really enjoy the process, and so to work on such a project. Several of the items were brought up that are important. There are things that are certainly are being considered, and more can be considered in the mitigation, for mitigation. One of them that's mentioned is the lights. And I don't know if you guys, you're probably familiar with Preston Park, and that was that was King County owned land that was headed for to be an industrial park. The Little League group, the soccer group, the Preston Community Club came together. They formed a nonprofit LLC to develop that and give it back to the King County Parks, and that has the lights on it, and they are those are what we would call second generation field lights. And
Chris, could you summarize?
Okay, they have tremendous cutoff. What's proposed now, third generation is even better. So there are many ways to meet these concerns you have and still have this great entity that connects, interconnects, and enhances a lot of the activities that you guys are thinking about and here to represent. So,
thank you for your comments. Okay, is there anyone else who wishes to speak or submit a comment that has not signed up? Yes,
sorry, I
please.
Step. My name is Corey Coker. I'm at 42738 Southeast 170th Place, North Bend. I work in the industrial park right next door, and I'm just concerned about driving on 202. The traffic at 55 miles an hour is just going to get worse as we grow. And, I'm just concerned about turning on that road.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. Okay, anybody else wishing to speak? Yes, sir. Please state your name and address for the record.
Grant Lutz, 6809 Silent Creek Avenue Southeast, Snoqualmie. We actually just purchased the North Bend, all about by a little side trailhead in a month. Been a coach and member of the park board of Snoqualmie, Little League president, Fall City, all that kind of stuff. I'm not going to repeat all the kid things, because the people that know me know that that's what we do. The other thing, I just want to set some context for people too. Like tonight in this weather, we would actually practice baseball. We do it in baseball all the time. The reason we don't is usually by the field, but we were in the Ravensdale last year for our high school tryouts, and it was literally, couldn't see across the field, we were out there practicing. So if you're going to play baseball in the Northwest, you need a facility that will help us do that. So we're really excited about that. The one thing I want to set also context is the opportunity for economic development for you guys. I don't know if you realize in the four field setting that they have those Little League fields, you can run it to a tournament with like 20 teams, which, I don't know, what's that, 400 families coming into your community for a weekend. I've been to tournaments and traveled over the state and these things. We're getting flyers in our cars for restaurants, we're eating pizza, we're doing all that kind of stuff. Meadowbrook, we can set up a little food court there that you can make money off that kind of stuff. There's a lot of opportunities around the facilities like that, and including basketball. So not just the fields for the kids, but I think there's a lot of economic stuff you guys can do for your city to even take advantage of this more, even with the generosity of the plan. There's a lot of benefit for the people around that as well. I don't know why I'm so nervous talking to you guys. You're a little kid, you'd be all right. So yeah. Thanks for the chance.
Thank you for your comments. Appreciate it. Okay, is there anyone else who wishes to speak? Okay, well, go ahead and close the public hearing. It looks like 8:01. I want to thank everybody in the public for coming out and for speaking tonight. We always love to hear from you and hope you come to all their future meetings, even when the topic is not so inviting. It makes our time go faster. So I'll give you those. Staff, I don't know who would like to start with some of the questions that were asked. I caught a couple. I know you guys are really good at doing that.
I actually have a point.
Yes, sir.
Did we understand earlier that there would not be voting tonight on this?
Correct. But we can proceed with questions. And
I was just thinking we might want to let the folks know we're not going to be voting on tonight.
Yeah, so just to let everybody know, because we don't have a quorum, that we would not take a vote tonight. So we'd be at our next scheduled meeting if we have a quorum.
The next scheduled meeting.
I'm sorry?
We have a quorum for the meeting, but we've had one recuse themselves from the vote, and we need three to vote. So what we will have to do is, I can go into that now. We'll just stick with that topic for
sure.
Okay. So
We have also, we're going to talk to you about schedule anyways. So the Planning Commission meets on the 27th. Regular scheduled meeting is the 27th of this month. All of the planning staff do plan to be at an American Planning Association conference that week, so we were going to ask you already to, if you would be willing to reschedule that meeting. We are going to push it back a week, but what I'm going to suggest possibly is we push it forward to the 20th of October, which would be next Thursday night. Are you on that night? So, if the three of you, what we're going to have to do since Mr. Ryan has recused himself is, if Jim and Gary, you're available that night, we're going to have to assume that one of the remaining members, if not all of them, can also be there that night. So we'll try to get that confirmed tomorrow, but does that work for the two of you?
I can confirm I am available on the 20th.
Okay.
Probably.
Okay.
But I say our odds of having a quorum are greater next Thursday than they are at the moment.
Right. Yeah. So, so we will plan for October 20th next week. So what that means will be the first time, so the Planning Commission can deliberate. We'll ask the remaining Planning Commission members to review the tape so they come in prepared. They can make a recommendation that night, and that means it would go to City Council November 1st. So that is what I think the schedule will be.
Go to City Council November 1st?
Yeah, that would be the first City Council meeting subsequent to the 20th.
Can I ask you a question?
Do you mind this question?
No, go ahead.
The City Council meeting is on the 18th, is that right?
Yes, there is one.
So we're going to just further delay. Is there any way that we can have you guys get together before the City Council? And if it's approved, then it goes to the City Council, is that right? And then they can do their vote on it?
So, I won't get into the legal ramifications of development agreements, but the municipal code requires a recommendation from the Planning Commission.
Is the City Council October 25th?
The City Council meeting, there's a work study that night. There is not a City Council meeting. So, that is the schedule in order to get a recommendation out of Planning Commission. Yeah.
That's what it's got to be.
Commissioner Rancher? Sorry.
Yes.
I thought you said at the beginning of this meeting that the City Council can take up any subject even without a recommendation.
That is correct.
So the City
If they so choose.
Okay. Yes.
I don't know the rest of it. That's
Got it.
They do that to us often.
So there is a precedent.
No, actually, they've only done it once. We have a kind of a potential legal scenario setting up from a process standpoint, I want to make sure the project follows a process, that there is no appeals or anything like that. More for just clean and so it works for both parties. That is one aspect I will legally look into, the option for next Tuesday, but again, that means your Planning Commission will not have a recommendation. So right now, regardless, the Planning Commission's schedule would be for the 20th, unless for some other reason you hear different.
Yeah, I would ask the staff maybe to get an email to the rest of the Planning Commission to see if they can have that special meeting, make sure that we have a firm commitment before we... That's it.
So okay. That being said, if you want to get into questions...
Go with the question.
I've got three or four that can probably be answered.
Hold on. I want to do the public comment ones first.
Okay.
Okay, first there was a question about a bike lane. And the municipal code has standard street standards, and this particular street does have a standard to have a bike lane. We have thought quite thoroughly about this topic, and a bike lane, when you're on a bike on a road, you function just like a car. So if there's a driveway, you're required to treat that driveway or that intersection just like a car. So adding a bike lane adds no additional complexity to a road other than another vehicle that is under the same rules and regulations as the vehicle. So the bike lane will be designed appropriately for a driveway just like a car entering and having to deal with crossing the sidewalk or what have you. One thing we did think about with this is Meadowbrook Farm, from the site through Meadowbrook Farm into Snoqualmie, does not have a bike lane. And because it's publicly owned on both sides, so therefore the road will not see really any, there won't be development that drives widening or anything like that, it most likely will not. This is a road, though, that does provide a pretty significant road biking entrance into town. The city is interested in ensuring that all forms of recreation and transportation are available as we work to provide a complete street and a complete community for all. So what we did think about was a bike that was coming down a nice narrow country road and enters into a very different environment where you have quite a bit of traffic. And having that bike lane does provide a refuge area, a safety aspect for those bikes. That being said, we are also requiring a kind of the road standard does have, we're taking the approach that you'll see up at Meadowbrook Farm where you have the meandering asphalt trail to kind of keep that nice pedestrian safety and amenity, also for strollers, slower bicycles, skateboards, whatever other hardscape form of movement we want to see. So that's why we went with that, and it's a new, you know, it's something we can design and make safe.
Just add to that also is frontage improvements, the bike lane, bike pathway, anything else are done only within the right of way, so they wouldn't take up any property into the site, and they're also only on the frontage of the development, so it wouldn't be in the front of the Encompass property.
Thank you. And then there was a question on 14th, and I actually missed what exactly the concern was. I think it was just coordination of 14th as it enters 202 and Bulch, and just the safety of that.
My question regarding 14th was traffic, the safety, and then also if there were any other improvements being required as part of the development along 14th that might impact the property.
Okay, so at the frontage, the developer will be required to develop the frontage improvements, mm-hmm. which will include sidewalk and the planter strip, those amenities, but in front of yours, no. Not until Encompass decides to do something that would trigger frontage improvements in front of Encompass.
Also, we heard about the concern of safety at 14th and 202. One of the recommendations in the traffic analysis from the applicant is to slow down the speed limit on 202, and our transportation consultant has reviewed and concurred with that. So as a part of the process, the speed limit on 202 in the vicinity of this development will likely be lowered.
So I don't have any other questions that I heard.
I have a question, I think, just staff, based on the public comment, so if the commission will allow me just to kind of vet that out. We were talking about, or I heard comments on light pollution, or what I interpret as light pollution, and we heard some comments that were talking about different generations of light standards. How does that play into what this commission and city council just passed with their own lighting standards, where they were LED in a certain color so they would limit glare, and they are under the Dark Sky Association's compliance? Mm-hmm. So if you want to speak
sure.
to kind of
yeah,
that.
I'll speak to that. So what the Planning Commission was looking at there was the city's public road lighting standards, so street lights. And the commission and the council did pass then some requirements about the light temperature, the color it is to minimize glare, and full cutoff requirements. This is on private property, so it's under a different lighting regulation. There are full cutoff lighting requirements for the parking lots, not for field lighting. That's a little bit more difficult to achieve because of just the need to provide angles.
Okay.
So that's one thing we've heard and thought about. So we did add a condition on page 3 of 16 that does kind of address that. And the review to kind of determine if the applicant has kind of provided best available options to screen the night sky or to shield the light pollution and, will be done with the development review, and potentially there could be additional conditions with the SEPA process.
Okay, the next question I have is on sound, and I know that we limit how much noise can go outside a wall on commercial projects. Mm-hmm. How does that relate to sports fields? Is there any comparison, I guess?
Let's see. Let me grab real quick our noise ordinance, because yeah. it's not use space. It's a zone, so at a certain at the property line, it has to be an X decimal. So it would not be it wouldn't be different because it's a ball field or a industrial use or an employment.
It'd have to hold to the same standard of whatever that decibel level is? Or
It's a little different in that I believe there's exemptions for human voices. So people, it's a little hard to control the crowd. You know, quiet crowd.
That's why 100 little girls.
Yeah, that's why I'm
These
trying to get to.
These are some of the questions that we're going to wrestle with in the review of this, though, is how do we mitigate noises like that appropriately? Mm-hmm. To minimize impacts to adjacent.
So you're talking about the way that the buildings might be positioned to shield the open fields or something like that, or direct the sound towards the highway versus open space.
We have just began. I mean, this is the beauty of the public process: is you get to hear the comments, the concerns, and then you start analyzing mitigation measures for them. Things like those are good examples, whether they fit this one or not, or, they could be, typically these type of fields don't come with the high school noise, with the bands and the announcements, because you're usually playing 4 or 5 games at a time. So there could be conditions of addressing whether that's appropriate or not, things like that. So we're considering different ways to make this a good partner for the neighboring uses.
Okay. With that, I guess I'll open up to the Planning Commission for general questions. Yes. Commissioner Lucky, you'd like to go first?
Yeah, I'll bring up another question later, but there's a couple things that caught my attention as I read through this.
Okay.
First one is particularly silly.
Where are you at?
I'm on page 2 of 16. I smiled, actually, as I read. The census reads the project is approximately 12 acres of almost entirely vacant. And if that's our writing or someone else's. I don't know how you do almost entirely. And then, was there, I didn't see it in here, but there's a mention of turf. But I have a 13-year-old, and there's several others that are younger that play soccer and play on turf. And I think it was about a year ago, there was a lot of hype about certain kinds of turf and the underlayment that keeps it stable was actually proven in some small scenario to be carcinogenic. I'm thinking, let's put this in the table if we can to make sure that somebody's paying attention to that. it's old rubber tires. Let's maybe they didn't come from some other country or something like that. I didn't see it in here other than just mentioning curb. I presume that the indoor space might have indoor soccer, but I didn't read that. I heard basketball. Anybody else?
She's saying indoor soccer will be available.
Very cool. I love to watch that game. Can't play it anymore. It hurts too much. View of Mount Si, particularly the taller building. If we look down North Bend Way, if we go out 202, and we think about our planning, you know, the structures that we have, I know that's a big deal when we get into the city limits. I just want to not forget it here. Just to keep it on the radar. And is it a total of six tax parcels? Is that what's being used?
There's one, two, three, four, five, six.
Yeah, I see that. They would know better than us. And then one thing I also want to think about is I'm going to assume the city council is going to approve this in some form. Is there a way to get a head start on phase two and the approval process for phase one? Is there some way we can get that approval started so they are in a better place to get started when they're ready?
Let me make sure I understand. The development agreement covers both phases. The most likely, the engineering will cover both places because they both play together. In the realm of designing the site. You can't have stormwater without designing the whole site. I think the only part that they're actually jump-starting on is the fields for other reasons beyond, I don't think that helps them. Okay. When they get their engineering plans approved, it will be for the entire site.
So in other words, they're put in their infrastructure for sewer, which is required for phase two, but that doesn't really matter until we run our line to theirs. So, okay.
That's all I have. So,
Commissioner Ryan, any questions for staff?
No comments, Chair.
All right. Let's see. First one I have is on page two, just on the parking requirements. And just wondering, I didn't have time to look up if we were having a retail center. What are we basing our spaces on, and how does that compare to the space requirement that they have for this facility?
You mean spaces in number or size?
Number of spaces.
So if you go in our parking code, it actually has a section for fields versus it also has a section for retail, which is different. It's based on square footage. Fields are based on number of players. So we are following our code in that. For the fields.
And we also based the code requirement in the development agreement. We became more specific and more stringent to base it on what would be anticipated for little league size teams. So you're going to get more players on the field with more players on each team, and therefore we based it on that to make sure that we're not having a parking shortage.
On page 3 of 16,
not quite yet. We do have a handout for 4, so go ahead.
Okay. 3 of 16, just some preference on language. The maximum impervious surface area, item number 6, the fields are required to be permeable and therefore are not to be calculated, would be my preference. So if that's what we're actually requiring,
We're not requiring them to be permeable. What we're trying to establish is the fact that the swim manual requires treatment of the runoff from those fields for numerous reasons. That being said, they still allow water through them. So when calculating that 55% limitation, we wanted to be clear that the fields actually let water through. So we're not calculating that like the same as we are calculating a parking lot. That doesn't eliminate the need to treat it per King County Code. So we aren't requiring pervious fields. They just are that way.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that okay?
Yeah. It's just the wills. There's something I don't like.
I would use should be calculated.
Shall. I think we should say shall.
Okay.
I hear a chainsaw in the morning.
Yeah.
So on page four, I do, Mike has left at your table some edits to the document. And unfortunately, they printed the same color as all the ones you've seen before. So they are, and do you have extra copies?
Yeah.
The audience who would ever like to see them. They relate to the sewer system. Basically, what we wanted to provide was just a clarification into that the site plan provided is conceptual and has not been fully reviewed for consistency with the North Bend Municipal Code or engineered, and that final engineering plans shall be reviewed and approved by the city. That's normal behavior, normal steps. The crossouts or strike-throughs that you have in item Roman numeral 2 and 3 and the addition of Roman numeral 4 is simply because as we looked at the development agreement in closer today and or in a different light, I should say, realizing the level of detail related to the sewer issue versus the level of detail of engineering, we felt that it's probably important right now to not put that level of detail into the development agreement because there could be some modifications that not only benefit the developer or benefit the city in a partnership or might just be a better solution for sewer on the site. Their requirement is to serve their site and not the whole region or the whole area. So this provision is just to allow the ability for the engineering process to occur.
Okay. Any questions from the Planning Commission? Thank you. All right. Any other final comments, guys? Okay, so we'll move on then to item...
Do you mind if I'll just make one last comment on the schedule? And this is just to kind of let everybody, because everybody doesn't... I have to admit, I don't think I've been to a public hearing where everybody comes in support, or mostly in support. So anyway, so back to the schedule. The development agreement will come back to the Planning Commission, but the applicant is still working on their conceptual engineering. And they have a lot of steps to still go through to even get to kind of a final application package. That part can still happen at their own risk while the Planning Commission finishes their job and takes it to City Council. So just because the schedule got pushed back a little bit doesn't necessarily, I can't confirm that the Planning Commission is going to recommend X or Y and the Council is going to make the decision, but there still is the opportunity for progress in the meantime. Just to kind of let everybody feel maybe okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. So the Planning Commission will move on to our deliberation and recommendation on amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 18.10.030 to allow RV parks in the IC zone and amendments to 18.10.050 providing additional performance standards concerning RV parks.
Point of order, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to make a matter of record that my vote, would it be asked, would be to move this on to City Council effective tonight. I realize we're not voting, but that's going to make it a matter of record.
Thank you, Commissioner Leff.
Thanks for coming, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For having
us. Don't miss the City Council when they're talking about it.
Okay.
We were all here for this topic. I hope they do the same thing with City Council.
Okay, so RV parks in the IC. Any updates or changes that you want to alert us to, Mr. McCarty?
What you see on page 5 is the changes that were not in your last go-around in yellow highlight. So everything that you see in red was at your last meeting. Everything in yellow is new since that time to address the comments that we heard from you.
Okay.
So just added in B there, type 3 landscaping, just for a little more specificity. C, or just a little bit of language change there. D, wanted to add that it's evergreen trees, just for consistency with the character of the surrounding area. Under F, so this is where we previously had language about having a 20-foot buffer to protect the forested character along I-90. The plat of the Edgewick Village from 1980 actually specifies a 50-foot buffer. And so rather than have a 20-foot buffer reference there, when we're just making reference to the already existing requirement under the plat to preserve the forest and that native growth protection easement.
Yeah, that buffer 50 feet is even questionable. That the noise on I-90 is so dominant that any buffer's not going to be, won't be a sound buffer at all. It'll simply just slow it down from getting through. But my presumption is that that's primarily what the buffer stores for sound.
Now the buffers, well, I can't speak to what the buffer intent was in the original plat because I wasn't involved in creating that. We just know it's a native growth protection easement. When we were developing or drafting the language for purpose of it, when we had a 20-foot buffer there, it was for visual purposes from I-90, not to the benefit of the RV park, but to the benefit of the Mountains to San Marino corridor.
Okay.
But certainly it also provides a little bit of the sound attenuation
for
the occupants of the RV park.
Okay.
Because you were talking about people staying there for weeks at a time or a month, they probably would like to have consideration in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Do we have a limitation on time? Did I hear 90 days was the max?
Yeah. 90 days, yeah. It was at 180 days, and just considering that, we thought that 90 days was a better limitation to keep it from being set up more of a permanent residence type of situation.
And then there's got to be some additional language that would not allow that 90-day occupant to move next door for another 90 days, right? There's something.
We don't have that, but it just says the maximum length of stay shall be 90 days in any one calendar year.
So I'm...
Hold on one second. Mike, were you done with your updates to us?
I'll keep going.
Okay. Can we hold?
Yep.
So H...
That's right.
Previously had said 20% of the sites. We felt like the mini cabins, there really isn't a tremendous impact of that on the RV park use or on public interest, aesthetics or noise or whatever. So we thought 30% was probably appropriate for the Planning Commission to consider. We provide a little bit more specificity based on the comments that we heard about aesthetics. So that RV park model includes skirting to cover the chassis area and the wheels. That the buildings, including the cabin units, be stained or painted a darker natural tone and not use vinyl or metal siding. Heard that from the Planning Commission last time. We also expanded it so it's not just park model RV units, but say that the cabin units can be park model RVs, yurts, or a site-built cabin in the same approximate size of an RV park model. And then finally, under J, just a provision there to keep things neat and tidy. RV parks shall keep all grounds and sites well-maintained, ensure the occupants don't store equipment or belongings in quantities beyond that typical to camping or vacation use. Just again, so it's not starting to look like a permanent residence.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for that update and for including our thoughts in there, Mike. I really appreciate that. So with that, I believe, Commissioner Lucky, you had a thought that you wanted to...
Yeah, I'm looking at it from the landowner, to me, he's got this great idea. Let him run with the ball. He's not going to screw it up because it's got financial focus and he's got a vision and I don't mess it up with all the details, overlay. But then I also think about things as they may evolve if we allow this 90-day thing. If it's not crystal clear, we could end up having somebody run it like a mobile home park where it becomes semi-permanent residence. maybe that's not such a bad thing, but I know we're not talking about it that way. So I guess I'm wondering, is the language significant enough, strong enough, that it'll survive the test?
So you're talking about point C, RV park shall impose a maximum length of stay 90 days in any 1 year period. Are you thinking of any single occupant or any named occupant, or, you know?
Those campgrounds.
What if they come summer and winter? Is that a big issue?
I don't think it should be 90 days in a year. Maybe it's 90 something with a consecutive, some kind of break. I mean, obviously coming and going. I could see this kind of thing evolving into a portion of it being apartments for people. Mm-hmm.
I think the impact that we were trying to get out there was the overall aesthetics and character of the RV park. We don't want it to look junky.
I guess my response to that, knowing what Norwest does, is in the summertime they're packed full, and Valley Camp has been full, you know, partly because of the road construction. And then they had the Japanese foreign exchange students? I mean, so I think there's enough of demand of campers and motorhome association people that they'll fill this, where that might not be the problem. But are you thinking maybe it could end up where he has all these permanent structures and that takes away from the ability for all these RVers to come in?
Well, in one area he's setting up, he's following a trend, the tiny house trend. Well, most of those, you'd have to charge a premium to justify the expense of putting it in place in the first place. And that premium starts to get where somebody's willing to pay, you know, $2,000 a month to camp versus $3,000 a month to be in a mobile home down the street. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, we've got another mobile home park just at a lower rate. That's,
well, if you can afford $3,000 a month, that might be a mortgage.
Right.
You know, you could certainly rent some of the apartments we're going to have in town, or stay in one of the hotels for $88 or $90 a month, right?
Yeah.
So
I guess I'm just saying, if we're going to include the language, and I think we should, then it ought to be strong enough to serve that function. And I'm just checking with you to see.
The thing that, and this is the reason that I added the RV park shall impose rather than the maximum length of stay is the city does not want to be out patrolling this. We don't want to be saying, oh, you guys have been here too long.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but if we say the RV park shall impose, we can see that they have a law on their internal books that says 90 days. There it is. They're the ones that are then having to enforce it.
Yeah.
And if it looks like it's starting to become a problem from the city, again, from the aesthetics character perspective, then we can look back and say, it doesn't seem like you guys are keeping it clean. Make sure that you're enforcing this. Mm-hmm. But I think we don't want to get involved in is having to be policing a particular use.
I agree with that. Let me just drive one more level of it. If the economics of things change, and they do, what we're thinking of is a campground on steroids could evolve, particularly if the economy goes down, to becoming a place where people live, period. Because that's what the owner will have in his hand at the moment, and that's going to be the way it works.
Well, in theory, some people do live in their RVs. They sell their home, they go RVing for a few years, and then they sell their RV and settle wherever they enjoy the most, right?
Yeah.
But you're saying as a permanent residence, what is the concern?
Are you saying it's not a concern? And
well, if we're going to have language in there that restricts, because it's a campground, if we're going to think of it as a campground, and that says, well, people aren't living there, you won't live in a campground normally. I don't want to spend too much time on this. It's bugging me a little because I can see driving through there 10 years from now.
You're hitting on the same.
And I'm thinking, I didn't think this when they were talking about it.
You and I are on the same wavelength, Jim.
So
I think these are examples of what we don't want to have. These are visual blights, this kind of thing. I think this is, when I look at, you know, what's being contemplated there, I'm thinking about more of a campground, but a real campground where you have rows and rows of systematic cabins, you know, for different size families and so on, but it has a pattern of neatness to it. It basically is not intended to look like a neighborhood. It's intended to look like a camp. Mm-hmm. And people will feel organized about that, and they won't stay there. They'll move on out because there won't be this kind of thing. It won't be some little kiddie ground for their kid to play in. They're going to pack up the kids. They're going down into the Little Fork and do camping. They're going to camp and walk and hike and come back to their campground. So I would argue strongly against the aesthetics of my mind is nothing like this. Very regular and uniform. Maybe not a forest green kind of a thing, but I would argue for a minimal amount of variation to keep it orderly in appearance and make people feel like they're moving into something that everyone has. They don't have an equity issue. Everyone has the same stuff, the same lifestyle, and basically is situating them to go into the environment to have fun on a camping basis. And I work very hard not to have this kind of look there.
Well, I think the pictures that you're showing there would not be allowed under what the standards are that we talked about with requiring natural tone, colors.
But even these two-story things, I mean, they're nice. It shows what you can do in a small environment.
Well, we could say with no attached decks or porches.
Yeah, but I would just keep the exterior looking as systematic and as simple as possible. Make size of the difference because of the variation of family size, but I would try and keep a uniformly appearance. Something we're trying to work against in our rural home communities, but in this, I would keep this, I don't want to use the word, but I will, almost militaristic, keeping it very, very systematic where you have, I'm in camp, cabin 42.
National park system.
Yeah.
Federal parks.
And not that, they'll be comfortable inside, they'll be warm and cozy, and people will want to come there and camp because it's just that, it's not cluttered. This kind of thing invites clutter.
I'm trying to figure out how to put your sentiments into language for the code, and is it to say that you don't want attached decks and porches, or does it need to go further than that? That's pretty much getting you one area. He could still do whatever inside it and still make it as big or small as he can for the space, but that takes away any outside differences.
Yeah, his cabin in the city is a studio.
Let me make a, because maybe the picture is hurting the set. So in my mind, if you have 30% that are allowed to be cabins, and I picture, I mean, let's just say, I'll just picture the best scenario in my mind. It's RVs that are intermixed in the trees, the picnic tables, and then you have, a certain amount of whatever that 30% number is. Let's say it's 15 little cabins. And those little cabins, on average, when you think about the ones you've stayed at that are intermixed with RV parks, often they do have a nice little front porch or a little back porch that you can, because that's the amenity that you're usually paying a little higher price for to stay into the cabin. So instead of that picture of the porch, because I agree that picture is not that, that's what I think Mike was showing us, and one that would not be used. Mm-hmm. What I'm wondering, if we, in an effort not to restrict something we want to see, do you think it's the park model RV design that is the concern? Because if it was a site-built cabin or a yurt, does that have a different result in your mind?
My concern is that this particular project is too close to that commercial intersection. It's too close. It needs to be further back down the road, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Because we have too much at stake to make a mistake here and put this in just because somebody wants to do it. I think that this campground belongs to, it belongs deeper into the woods, deeper down the road.
But you can't tell the landowner.
Yeah, and there isn't much land to do that on because most of it's DNR.
The question the Planning Commission has to consider, is this an appropriate use in this zone?
If it, so you do residential, or maybe what sort of residential could be applied to this zone? Zero, right?
Right.
You could do hotel, motel, right?
You could.
Is that considered residential?
No.
No, hotel. No, hotel, motel.
So, no residential. So the applicant couldn't come to us and ask for something residential.
Right. No.
And that's why I think Dick and I, you were on the same page with me with slightly different reasons. I'm looking at 90 days as the threshold of saying it's not residential. You get to 91st day, and now we're over into leasing and tenant landlord laws and all kinds of crazy things.
Yeah. I like the Mount Everest design. It has a little front porch, and it seems pretty uniform and boxy as you're describing. Are you saying this is what you would like to see?
No.
Because I think that, to me, would be...
Is your concern about the height of those?
The height?
Because that's something that we could easily address in the performance standards, saying one-story only.
Since we're trying to attract RV campers and camping, making this a camping experience, I would. We're not going to reduce the size of the RV. If you have a big landlord drive in, they're going to park there, right? I mean, they're not going to be. So the scale is going to be really cattywampus. You have these big 45-foot long land yachts up against these little 18-foot cabins. It's going to be really out of scale, and that's going to be aesthetically a problem. But my recollection of a campground in the woods, if you've ever been to Pack Forest down by Eatonville, UW Pack Forest, that's the kind of campground I'm thinking about. They have about 15 four-person cabins where the students stay, and they're all the same. They have two rows, and they're just systematically lined up with a mess hall at the end of it. And
camp run amok.
Kind of like that. Huh? But the thing of it is, it happens to be, in my opinion, well, it's always my opinion, but I've been around a lot, that's the kind of thing people look for when they're going to have a camping experience where they don't have their own vehicle. They're going to go. If they have their own RV, they're not going to have something like this. They're going to be taking out something pretty expensive. But for the people who don't have the money for that, they understand the economics of a small cabin. They're not looking to spend what it costs to spend overnight in a big hotel. They want economy. They might even want a cafeteria in there where you have people go to and make their own dinners and even buy their dinners in the cafeteria, bunkhouse style.
Well, this is responding to a market demand. There are an increasing number of RV parks that have park model RVs for rent in them.
I know.
I did a web search and found a number of them, not so much in the Puget Sound area, just because we're
my kids.
I guess
there's all due respect to you on this one, but I just think we're jumping out of demand when we're not, there's probably demand for other things that we're not putting there. I don't think this is this kind of product should be right at our gateway. It's at the gateway to the Middle Fork, and I don't think that's what we want to have.
Specifically the park model RVs?
Yeah.
So I think that's the question. I mean, it sounds like Mr. Bryant is not necessarily that. The park model RVs is not part of the RV park. So in the end, you'll have to decide.
Mm-hmm. So my question to you, Commissioner Ryan, is when you go to the Middle Fork, there's 34 or 39 campsites at the campground back there, and most of the illegal ones have been blocked off or made into car parking for trail access. So if I'm coming to the Middle Fork and I arrive a day early and my campsite's not ready, this gives me a place to stay where I don't have to unpack my gear. Is that a good use of the park model RV?
Yes, I wouldn't think that'd be the average. That'd be the minority person who'd come that way. When most of them come, they're coming to a prepared site, they're ready to move in.
They might come stay here to clean up on the way home.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to make a decision. Maybe it's tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, I've arrived early sometimes, and, you know, you're not, your reservation's the next day, but you have off and you want to go scope it out. Well, we'll have a hotel by then. I'm just saying, if that's not a good scenario, I'm trying to think of, you know, what else is, and it's passes closed and I stuck in my car, and this is a great alternative to that for one night.
So I don't want to have a bee in my bun for too long, but I feel like I'm still on the crux of what solves all these problems. You talk about a campground. If you think about camping in any occasion for more than 7 days, you're not camping anymore. That's unique. Mm-hmm. Most campers are like 2-3 nights, and they're on the way to something else. So the idea that somebody might stay anywhere, quote, camping for 90 days is...
I think when you're in an RV, though, it's maybe different. You get retirees.
Well, that's not a campground. It's an RV facility.
Mm-hmm. When I go to Yellowstone, if I go to Jackson Hole, I'm going to be in a cabin, the one I've been kind of talking about, pretty Spartan. But I'm stuck there for 7-8 days because I can't find a better place to stay.
Yeah.
In terms of things to do and all of that. And I'm going to be able to walk into Jackson Hole and go shopping. I'm going to be able to walk out to wherever else in Pine Mountains. And I think that this kind of facility is not going to create that kind of amenity we're looking for, the gateway to the Middle Fork. It just seems like it's, if we were further back in off the road, this is so close to the, all you have to do is cut down a 100-foot swath of trees and this thing's going to be right away exposed.
So your concern is aesthetics?
Yeah.
Okay.
And you kept saying number of aesthetics. These are not, these are eyesores.
Okay, so we're back to the fact that your concern is the park model or the cabin, yes. Not the RV.
The structure.
Okay, so let's table that concern for a minute. Remember, what we're doing tonight is we're adding a P to the chart and the performance standards. So right now, this property is zoned in interchange commercial. That means it could have a McDonald's on it, or it could have a numerous different
gas station
or numerous different higher maybe impact. So if I think one question you might want to clarify is, are you okay with the camping, the RV aspect of it? And if so, then what we need to do is address your concerns for the cabin aspect.
I think the two things are that. It's cabin and length of stay. Or conditioning that. So, yes, you're... Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm coming from Idaho. I'm going to hop on 80, come up 90, come into town from Idaho. And I'm either going to have a motel that I'm going to stay in, or I'm going to have a cabin that I'm thinking about in my own mind's eye. See, but I would rather stay in a woodsy cabin for a week than stay in a motel or stay in something with wheels on it. I mean, I just would.
So that's why I was saying, if it's the park model RV, and if the council planning commission chooses to, you can actually take out the word park model RV and go with yurts and site-built cabins. That steps up the notch, the level of your RV campground. Because now, you know, I actually stayed in one of these recently where the camping, I could have had my RV there and paid, I think it was either $30 to $50 a night for the parking spot to plug in, but I paid $120 for the cabin. It was a stick-built cabin, and they were oriented on one side of the park, and the RVs were on the other, and it was actually quite nice. So in my mind, that worked. So that's where I'm trying to get to, what is it is your true concern?
Commissioner Ryan, you feel that, would that meet your need?
That meets my need for an aesthetic experience in what's going to become a major recreational area. These are going to be here a long time, and they will probably expand. They'll probably expand the footprint. And they'll be known as something else than the Estep cabin community, whatever.
Spin doctors in the room.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I've got one for you.
Hold on. Before we go any further, let's just take care of this.
I'm still on it, man.
Okay. So it's in point H. Cabin units may consist of. We want to strike park model RVs. Is that correct? On page
no.
5. Page 5.H.
3.7.
So strike park model RVs and just may consist of yurts or site-built cabins of comparable size to a park model RV. Leave that one.
To an RV.
It
shouldn't say park model, to an RV.
Okay, so strike park model, change A to an RV.
You know, is this a consensus?
No.
Is
it?
No.
Okay.
I'm going to come back and then we would strike park model RVs shall include that entire sentence. So, Commissioner Ryan, after you catch up, let me know if that's what you're asking for. And so we'll have cabin units of yurts or site-built cabins.
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Lucky. Yes.
Is yurt a brand name?
I don't.
I thought it's a type of structure.
It's a type of structure.
Okay. I feel like I've seen ads. For you know, I saw a brand. I never knew what a yurt was until I ventured into Orcas Island a couple of years ago. I saw a yurt in Doe Bay. And they had all kinds of camping sites. And they had yurts there. I said, what the hell is a yurt?
It's with a T.
Yurt.
There you go.
And I saw one, and it was kind of cool. Yeah. It's a big round enclosure, tent probably, but I love the idea of it sitting out there in the promenade spot overlooking the sound. They can be cool, and people love those things. They have a permanency to them. And what I don't want, Mike, in all due respect to you, I don't want to see that corner where we're setting these up with this kind of a variety of park models. I think they will lend themselves to clutter. I don't think people will respect the area as much because it just looks like it's just
too temporary.
Too temporary, yeah. And so that worries me. And I think, and you've done a lot of work and research, this seemed like an answer to what seems to be something popular right now, but long term, this may not work.
Okay. Commissioner Lucky, thoughts?
How many spaces has he suggested the applicant?
Or Kent?
Not yet.
Is it 50 or 150?
It's going to totally depend on the amount of space he's got available and the provisions like the buffers and so forth. So we have no idea at this point.
All right, so I'm just going to use a safe number. I think 50. Just for my own couch. So if we had 50 spaces allocated on this much acreage, and if the applicant was actually coming in to say, I'd like to park containers on this lot, too high, 50 spaces, could he do it?
Containers? Like
shipping containers. Overseas shipping containers?
No.
Why not?
Well, that would be considered storage use, and storage is not allowed in that zone.
Oh, okay. I was thinking like a warehouse space could happen there. So not.
If you're just parking shipping containers, and then that's an outdoor storage use.
Okay, and truck parking?
Truck parking? Well, truck, yes. Yeah, that is, well, I can't remember what the provisions are in truck parking. Is it limited just to the existing truck town?
Yeah.
I'm trying to make some point in my... For myself, but also to kind of say, here's what we're being asked, here's what he could do.
I think I understand your point. You mean that this is a more desirable type of use than other potential uses that would be allowed in the IC zone.
Yep. I thought this the first time he presented it, and I think I said it. I was like, let's not, this guy's asking for something that's less invasive, if you use that term.
It can certainly be considered less invasive than a lot of other uses in that zone.
Okay. So do we want to review this change one more time and everybody agree? In point H, in the second sentence, we strike park model RVs. So it's cabin units may consist of yurts or site-built cabins of a comparable size to an RV. So we're striking park model in the end of the sentence, adding an N to the A to make an, and leaving RV. And then we're striking the entire next sentence, park model IV shall include skirt covering the chassis area and wheels. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. I'm not clear.
You're not clear, sorry.
No. So I'm trying to, as you make those changes, I want to make sure we're not eliminating park model RVs.
That's what the change does.
So I don't think that's where he's trying to go.
No, I am suggesting these smaller park model RVs.
So help me understand a park model RV. Is it the trailer? Is it
the one on wheels?
Is it
versus
a house?
Yes.
The one on wheels, right?
Yes. This is a park model. So these images that are in the packet
are all park model RVs. And I think that's a tiny house. That's what I think of when I see that. So is that the technical term? It's called a park model RV?
If it's on a chassis, yeah.
On a chassis.
So if my
where this goes would be in a mobile home community, but here we're trying to create an aesthetic into the gateway of the metaphor, and we have these rather
but
than.
What if I bring this in on the back of my fifth wheel, and I want to park it there?
Let me ask you to park it over in Truck Town.
I'm going to give just my two cents on this because I appreciate your thoughts and comments on the quality of the park model RV. And I've actually thought about it in depth. I know Mike's thought about it. We put thought into whether they can be mitigated to look like a cabin. I do think this is a highly desirable place to come and recreate and stay. There aren't a lot of options in the Upper Valley, even if we do get a hotel. So I do think there will be a market for a nice cabin. I don't think if you omit or delete the word park model RV, I still think that what you're doing is bringing a very nice option for accommodations, overnight accommodations in the form of RV and stick-built or site-built cabins and yurts. So I would say if it makes the council or planning commission more comfortable that you will ultimately have a higher level of an RV park, just delete the park model. You know, we went through, as you guys all know, you were part of it, a very elaborate and detailed effort to make sure our hotel came in as a high-quality hotel. You're doing the same thing here for an RV park, and I think that Mr. Ryan's concern is a legitimate concern, so I would recommend deleting park model RV and having actual cabins built. They probably will be tucked in the trees, and I still think that they'll be built.
Okay.
Is it saying the same thing to say that it's affixed to the land?
Site built versus.
Well, you've got came down on wheels, they just tie it to the land, like the mobile home story. It becomes affixed to the land. It's no longer a mobile home. It becomes part of the land.
You still argue whether it's aesthetically, to our design standards, the same as what you would have if you built a small home there.
Well, you could build this structure, right? This structure, which is what's got everybody's attention, you could build that just without the frame, without the frame axle.
Makes it have a wheel.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's what, I just asked Mike to clarify because he's done a lot of research on this. Good question, because there are actually a lot of non-site built cabins that are actually very nice that would come in on, because they're so small, come in on and be maybe just put together in two pieces on the site, and they still would look pretty, pretty good. So if the question is, I'm not sure. Park model, Mike said park model RVs, the actual definition includes wheels. That's the part that if this is actually a cabin, it doesn't need to roll around. That's where I feel like, mm-hmm. let's have RVs that roll and move, or cabins that are fixed to the space. So even at same site build, I would almost say yurts, cabins, or site built cabins, not park RV models. So it's clear that.
Yeah, let me just ask. There's actually law. There's real estate law that talks about a mobile home, mm-hmm. and the minute it's affixed to the land. It becomes real property. It's no longer personal property, which is the thing it came in on. So there's a technical shift that's long established. I'm just trying to, if we built this without wheels, would you still have a problem?
Yeah.
It's not, the, you know.
It's not a cabin in the woods.
Yeah.
This is like a container going down the dock.
So that's where I would think.
So my question, I guess, is we have design standards for cottage and for single family homes. Do we have design standards for, I guess, yurts and cabins in an RV zone?
Or the development as a whole would be subject to the commercial design standards and commercial use.
Yeah, I wonder if you went down and visited the Parks Forest Service office and see if they have what their standards are for U.S. Forest Service cabins. That might come close to what we're looking for.
I don't think that there probably is a uniform standard. I think different.
But they would probably have a catalog that they'd rely upon. Well, they have plastic cameras up there in the woods somewhere.
Well, you know, I also want to say, a cabin. This would. I'm trying to even think through what you just said because there is really no. Quote-unquote structure. The cabin would be considered a structure, but it isn't. It's not. It doesn't fall within any of the design reviews. So
it's typical.
Yeah, so what I envision is if you come in the IC zone and you want to build an RV park, we're going to go to the performance standards, and they're going to be here. I do think that there are many different ways to design a beautiful cabin. So I don't think we want to pigeonhole ourselves into one or two versions that are everywhere else in the United States. I think what's more important, for example, yurts, actually, the only thing in common on a yurt is the shape. So what I would almost recommend is, it sounds like you don't want the park RV model. Period. Delete that. Then the yurt site-built cabins, I mean, you're talking about 30% of how many were we even?
We were just contemplating.
15 of 50. It's 15 of 50.
15 of the 50. Thank you. So either A, you could push that back to 20%, so it's less of a percentage of the site. But I do think you want to keep that the flexibility in the cabins. Like, I've seen some really cool cabins that have, you know, aren't the typical pitch. They have that, you know, nice open roof line, and I don't know. So I just think that's kind of my two cents on options for cabins. I'd leave it a little more flexible. Just clearly eliminate what you don't want.
Thank you, Jenna. And I think that goes to your point that you always make is, why are we trying to contain and condition what this guy's trying to do with that piece of dirt which has nothing on it. So I kind of go along that same sentiment of yurts and cabins, although, you know, I think our design standards can influence and create the best of that design. I think we ought to give them some flexibility because, after all, it's a campground and, you know, I'm not going to expect granite countertops.
I'm going to say what you just said a different way just to drive my point home. If we let them stay over 90 days, it's no longer a campground in my mind. And this gentleman or entity said, you know, instead of putting the greatest eyesore that we have down at the interchange together, which is actually a pretty good business model related to trucking matters, you probably make a heck of a lot more money. He's saying, no, I'm going to get a campground. I'm going to tweak it a little bit, make it modern, make it unique, a little bit catchy. I'm going to make people drive the hour to come spend the night from Seattle. Let him run. Let him do what he wants.
Any concerns with a 30% of the site?
If that's his math, so be it.
Okay. So this guy owns a lot that he wants to build on. Is that what he is?
He's representing the owner of a lot.
Owner of a lot.
What's the lot size?
Well, again, I want to just say that this is for the zone. It's not for a specific lot.
Yeah, so it could be any zone, right?
Anywhere, I see.
What I'm trying to conceptualize is that this is the beginning of maybe a large recreational site that evolves from a 4-acre site to a 20-acre site, whatever. And we ought to set some very specific standards so we don't get a hodgepodge of things going on there. That we set clear standards. We have a campsite model.
Are you speaking to our gateway plans and how we treat each of our main entry points in our city and how we can master plan those?
Yes.
Well, we've got a trucking facility across the side.
So
this is a gateway.
This property is located behind the
Edgewood Camp.
This property will have.
Where am I?
That road right there, very far, behind Genie Corner,
whatever that.
Right here.
This property is behind the Edgewick Inn, and it is.
You already got an upgrade.
Part you have the buffering.
50-foot buffer.
50-foot buffer along the freeway, right? And 25 along.
Well, that
somewhere near the freeway.
This particular property, but
the backside is. Huh? The backside is against the freeway.
No, you got the cut.
No, probably 25-foot, 9 feet.
The side is.
That's where the exit.
This is the entryway into the camp.
990
and the opposite. So that's not over near the freeway. That's a whole other set of lots.
But the entire property goes all the way to the exit.
So this property does not front on 468. There is a 50-foot buffer along the freeway based on historical.
It's below the freeway.
So this is going to visually be screened from the freeway. You turn right or you come into North Bend and you'll still have the Edgewick or however that redevelops in the future. And you'll have the road heading to the Cadman Concrete. And behind the Edgewick will be this site.
But I thought I found this one, like I couldn't find the other one. But this one, I think, is on the paved road where you have the gas station on the southeast corner. If you go down the road, you get that manufacturing, the Genie, or that.
It's not the same road.
The lift. And I thought it was book in between. The access road to the gravel site and the road that is that allows access to Genie.
So this amendment applies to the zone as a whole.
But the property that the applicant is looking at is this back here.
Oh, I thought it was the site here.
No, that's actually owned by King County. King County's got a truck maintenance facility that they're proposing in there.
Start thinking about that. You go, okay, what is this guy thinking? For the campground here.
Well, it's close to the interstate, and so you can.
Well, the best part about this is that this one of the big trees are these trees here, about 20 years behind these trees.
No.
This is large trees in here, and those large trees are going to, in my mind, aesthetically, you need to put some money in there. You don't want to put these in there because. If those are big trees, almost demands bigger scale in terms of cabins and things of that nature. But it's noisy. My God, it's a noisy spot. I can't imagine anyone wanting to camp there more than a night.
Commissioner Lucky.
Yeah, so we've got the Park Model RV, which we beat to a pulp.
Mm-hmm.
I get the definition we're using for that. What about RV, period? In other words, I want to have 30% park model RVs. What if I had the rest of it as RVs? They're on wheels, they have engines, they could start, they could run, but the park guy, the own landowner, owns them. Now he's got parked RVs through the whole place, and he's running an apartment complex.
Well, we have in here that
30%.
What stops that from happening is H is specific to cabin units, 30% of the site.
for the purpose of short-term rental occupancy.
I hear where you're going.
Mm-hmm.
And
that'd be interesting.
RV park shall impose a maximum length stay of 90 days in one year. RVs shall not, this includes the actual RV itself, or
this is for the occupant and the RV
and any RV vehicle.
The more I walk both sites, and I was thinking on the site that it comes down close to the freeway, which is the one site you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
that clearly demands larger RVs, because they're going to be able to go under those big trees. There's enough clearance. The one I thought was the site, and I still think it, I don't know why I still think it is, those trees there are 34 years, maybe 40 at the most, and there's a lot of hanging limbs.
Are you supporting the buffer, the 20 feet?
So I'm saying...
retained? Because that's what's in here. I just want to keep to the code, because it's getting late, and
well,
so...
Okay, it's getting late, but we're planning the city here, and I'm just saying that those larger trees are going to be a lot more accommodating to larger RVs, because they can maneuver in there, they can turn and move. The other ones, you're going to be cutting down a lot of trees just to be able to put an RV in there, because they won't have any turnaround space. So I would limit it to the larger RVs. Larger RVs like to camp with their own kind, and have a set of established cabins.
Well, that's getting into managing the particulars of the use, which
okay.
I think
you're right.
Yeah, I mean, this zone, we could have this zone up here somewhere else. City Council could lose their minds and have all of a sudden we have the zone downtown North Bend. We could change the zone anytime once we put this in place. It could
mm-hmm.
be applied in other places.
So, Commissioner Lucky, are you okay with the removal of the park model as we stated?
I'm thinking, there's so many questions now. I mean, in one road, I want to have the guy just go do his thing. But as I'm realizing exactly where this is right now, I'm thinking, no matter what he does, there's a certain draw that's going to come to that parcel. It's truckers. Not the mom, dad, and the three kids.
I disagree, because I talked to the Northwest guys, I've talked to Valley Camp.
Yeah, but this is right behind...
They closed the place in Snoqualmie. King County closed the place in Snoqualmie.
This is a new use, though, so he's putting a lot of investment in. This isn't a four-year-old site that doesn't have very much overhead.
Well, and I'm going to speak to that, because the more we don't enable the desired mix of uses to come in, the more the ones that potentially cause different impacts stay the predominant use. So to me, it's like this. When you have a fallow piece of land, and we always have some issues with what goes on there, like whether it's, homeless camps or what have you, the minute you put a trail there and you have families walking through, guess what? The issues kind of go deeper in, to somewhere else.
Right.
Because now you have different positive aspects of the community playing and acting. And so in my opinion, right now, you have a piece of property that could either become, some pretty heavy, what I would think is not necessarily the ideal gateway. We have all the fast foods and everything down there, but highway-oriented type services. Or you could have a really nice accommodation option for families to come and enjoy, the Middle Fork. I think what you're going to find there is who's going to come out are the people that are hammering to come with their RV and their five kids and their three bikes on the back, and they're going to... maybe even ride their bike up the Middle Fork Road because there's no parking there, and this is the one location where you're going to actually camp and ride comfortably the bike right up. So I actually think by allowing this, you're going to diffuse some of that unwanted behavior and in engage more of the wanted behavior.
Yeah.
And it comes down to also course, you never know who your property owner and how well they manage or not manage.
Who the next owner will be.
You've been a million KOAs, and some are like pristine clean, and others you want, you know, you want extra thick flip flops on. So, I think, you know, in a way, I think the key is putting the provisions in place that we can go enforce if it's not kept in a manner we want. But I actually think this is a really nice option for families to come and join North Bend. So I'm kind of in favor of that idea. My two cents.
Yeah, no, I you're making good points. I'm thinking maybe 45 days. Is that a night?
Any reason behind that? I'm just wondering.
I'm concerned at some point in its evolution it'll become not a campground, but a residence of sorts.
And where does 45 in the methodology come
it's
in?
It's easier to control 45-day increments than 90. And 90, I mean, if you spend 90 days somewhere,
it's whole.
It feels mm-hmm. like you're leaving home when you're not there the next night. I mean, I know that experience. Yeah. So it's kind of like, 30 days, actually, is that sensation. Mm-hmm. So 45 days, if this guy's asking for 90, is that his proposal?
Well, he wanted 180, which is the current code.
Yeah. Current code for this
the
zone?
The current provision for RV parks is 180.
But not the zone, right? So he's...
Well, these performance standards apply regardless of zone.
Okay.
So wherever RV parks are allowed... Which is
we have any RV parks in the city?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who lives in a mobile home park for 180 days? Are they contractors that are on a specific job? Things like that? I mean,
in Norwest RV lot,
yeah.
He gets people that come in for a six-month Microsoft contract.
Okay, that's not that. You know, that's what they're for.
He gets the construction workers on the middle fork. He gets construction workers doing stuff in and around the city that live there.
Yeah, and that's a question, you know, like if you're looking at this as a recreational thing, I think, you know, you can always amend the code if it's a problem. 45 days is probably more than enough for the average camping family and what have you. So since you're allowing a land use that is right now not allowed, and you're wanting it to be, accommodate that family, 45, you know, if three of you feel comfortable with 45, I think that's a fair place to start.
So I'll drop the park model RV language, and if 45 days is acceptable to you guys, we have a deal.
I'm okay with 30.
What do you think? You want to go 25 days? I don't know, Laura. I think.
No, 1 month of hiking in the forest is.
So what if it's 30 consecutive days? Because then there's some fudge factor. He wants to play a game with a couple of people. He can, okay, you got to move next door now.
But if
he wants to go do that.
If these kind of facilities are being used by midterm employees, like you're saying, or based on consultants, then it's got to be more than 30 days.
Well, I'd say
it has to be allowed to re-up.
We have apartments being built, and we ought to make sure those are filled. And if the demand is so high for apartments that they're not met, then we will build more.
Yeah.
And maybe they're staying there because there isn't an option to stay elsewhere.
But whatever else we need to do to make that not become long-term housing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 45?
Yeah.
45. We all agree, 45 days.
I agree, 45.
Okay.
The word consecutive needs to be there.
Is that because it's a round number, and usually if it goes month to month, wouldn't it be 60 or 30?
And do we have language that says, what's 45 the 180 days you have for RV parks?
Right now what it says is the maximum length of stay is 180 days in any one calendar or any 1 year period.
Gary, what I'm saying is that if people move around month to month, they're going to have 15 days where they can't stay anywhere because there's... I have to be out of here and get the next place on the first of the month. When I'm leaving my 30th day, I'm going to want to be able to move to someplace that
I
doesn't.
I hear you. I just say that we have 45 maximum. You could leave at 30. You don't have to stay 45, right? You could leave if you're doing month to month and you're going to play that. But if you're going to be backpacking in the Alpine Lakes wilderness and you're going to be gone for 14, 18, 20 days...
And also face it, too, the landowner's got to realize this.
If he breaks the rule, what's the penalty? That's my next question.
Yeah, there's not
the enforcement penalty.
So the enforcement is if the city sees that it becomes a problem in terms of mess, and then we can go in and see, show us that you are keeping people limited to 45 days.
Then if he doesn't?
If he doesn't, then the city could take enforcement action.
Okay.
So here, let me see if this is the language. The RV park shall enclose a maximum length of stay of 45 consecutive days for any occupants or RV vehicles. Yes. Okay.
Now that covers all the mobile type vehicles, right? RV vehicles covers all of the
recreational vehicles.
Okay.
Trailer, camper.
Yeah, cool.
Point F. Mr. McCarty, I know that this is our code for RV parks, and the way we have this line written, it's specific to the easement in the Edgewood Village plat. Why wouldn't we want the buffer in anywhere that borders I-90?
It does. Oh, anywhere that borders I-90.
So.
Well,
we could say something like including that one, but if you're going to make an RV park in our other IC zone, why wouldn't they have the same buffer requirement? Do you understand what I'm saying? So if I am, this is I-90, right?
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the IC zone. So this is the reality of this is already built out, and it. Because those are highest and best at a lot higher level due to density and use, it's not likely ever to convert to an RV park.
What about the other side of?
That's not the IC zone, though.
That's not.
Were these RV parks? Are you guys considering the sound walls along the freeway?
That cities would not typically build a sound wall. That's usually done by the Department of Transportation.
Yeah.
When they extend the road.
But they wouldn't build that based on the city's request. It's a larger process, or at least not in terms of one use at a time type of things.
Well, the what triggers a sound wall is the freeway.
Maglev.
Not the. So, like, if you.
IMU is what I was thinking.
It kind of controls us when we want to site there. Seems like on our three major intersections. Noise is a huge factor, and they're not considering sound walls to help us out.
I disagree. I think sound walls don't fit within the aesthetics of our trees and our mountains. I drive through California, having recently been to Disneyland, and if I just only have palm trees and houses to look at, I can understand the sound wall, especially when they build a house, a residential house, right next to the freeway. I think... Let's think long-term and envision a day when the mine use has exhausted itself, DNR takes back the land, we have rail funding that brings tourists down the I-90 median right to the Middle Fork and Mount Si, and, you know.
In your hovercraft.
No, I'm just thinking, you know, rail line when it goes past Issaquah at some point.
That's it, maglev, man. Spokane. Work, commute.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep things moving.
Yeah, so, there's only three of us. We should be done by now.
Truckers would love that. They would just start pouring all kinds of trucks down I-80.
So
well, there's So my thought is just that is if it's interchange commercial, and we should have this consistent buffer, we shouldn't be one site specific. Does anybody? Disagree or have
buffers
different thoughts
inside IM?
No, I'm saying so we're having this reference to in point F the it's the
shall can I offer a suggestion? This again is a much more stringent requirement than what would apply to another use in the IC zone that would have potentially much more significant aesthetic impacts.
Yep.
So you could do a fast food restaurant or a gas station right next to the freeway. And so I think it maybe would be unfair to apply a buffering requirement to a lesser impact of use than a greater impact of use.
Mr. McCarty, I'd like to amend all our code to create a buffer zone. Could you put that on my wish list for next year?
Well, this has the buffer that's associated with the piece of property, yep. Regardless of use.
Yep. Okay. And so my point is just that, is maybe all our properties along I-90 should have some kind of a buffer or tree retention, because that's in keeping with our surroundings. Mm. So I don't know from the commission's point of view if you feel the same way or...
No, you're just taking somebody's land.
Okay.
When they already got to deal with I-90, now you make them move back farther away from it.
Well, that might be preferable.
I'm going to pay Taco Bell on the roof of my house when I build it right on the freeway.
Okay.
Charge for signage fee.
I will move on.
Where are you guys at with the language on the park model RVs? Were we striking?
Yes.
Yep.
Everybody in?
Okay. Struck.
Yep.
Park model RVs.
Do you need me to state it again?
I get it.
Okay. Any other comments or questions or thoughts?
Will the chair entertain a motion?
If you're ready for the question, I will.
I move we approve and send to council as currently amended.
So your motion is to approve as amended North Bend Municipal Code 18.10.030 to allow RV parks in the IC zone and amendments 18.10.050 providing additional performance standards concerning RVs. Any final comments or thoughts?
All the questions.
I support that amendment, that amended version. Yes.
Okay, so we have a motion by Commissioner Lucky and a second by Commissioner Ryan.
Yes, sir.
All those in favor say aye. Aye. The motion is passed unanimously.
Mr. Chair, given the hour and the weather, I move we table item 7.
And I think item 7 could go quickly.
Do you?
Well, I
You think?
Item right. 7 was just follow up on the one particular provision.
I retract my thought, given the expert opinion across the room. Let's carry on.
Well, I'm going to get my booklet.
What booklet? This is on page 12 we're looking at.
Can I give an introduction?
Yes. Mr. McCarty, yeah. We are moving on to... what did I do with my agenda here? Item number 7, Planning Commission deliberation and recommendation on the amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 14.12 floodplain management, associated minor amendments to 14.05 critical areas administration and general provisions and definitions, and 14.08 streams.
Okay, so last time that we read this, Planning Commission was ready to go with it, except for the issue of the hazardous materials. And the concern was we didn't want to store hazardous materials in an area where they could leak during the flood and cause potential human health or environmental hazard. So what we looked into is what's the appropriate language. Looked around at various codes and considered some Department of Ecology information. Talked with our building official, David Spencer, about how hazardous materials are addressed. And what we came back to is we felt the simpler statement was better, providing a prohibition on storage or processing of hazardous materials within the floodplain, and leaving that definition fairly broad so that we have latitude to say, you know, this overall category of uses is not appropriate, rather than trying to list very specific things and maybe leaving something out. We also just left it at prohibited to store at 3 feet above the base flood elevation or below. I didn't want to get into specifics of types of storage vessels or things like that. Those are regulated by the Department of Ecology when you're getting into hazardous materials processing or storage. It's also regulated by the fire code, and those have very specific provisions about how things are kept and quantities and so forth that we didn't feel we needed to duplicate in the flood regulations. Our principal concern is flood impacts. So if we felt that if we're keeping it above the level of the floodplain or 3 feet above the level of the 100-year floodplain, that provides a land use assurance that we're minimizing that hazard. And without getting into the details of how it's being managed within a particular business.
So 3 feet, what you're doing is preventing from it just floating away. The tank's not. Let's say the tank's only got a quarter of whatever the chemical is in it. It will float if water gets to it, right? That's what you're thinking about?
Well, 3 feet above, stored within a enclosed space.
See, my question is 3 feet high enough for a flood event? Are we high enough, or maybe you're missing why you're saying 3 feet?
The 100-year floodplain is presumed at a certain level. We're saying you have to be 3 feet above the 100-year floodplain. So that's a pretty safe measure that it's not going to become inundated.
So, Mr. Lucky, if I may go, and Mike, thank you very much for that introduction. And I thank you for doing the work to figure out something that would be best for our code. When I got back from my vacation, I had a brief conversation with Timothy Doyle from King County Emergency Management. He basically forwarded my comments to him back to Department of Ecology. I did research on the Department of Ecology website. I have Washington State Code, and Commissioner Lucky, I think you often say, isn't that already contained somewhere else or written somewhere else? And I found it in spades. So I want to say that there's one thing our state has clearly defined, and to what you're speaking to is where it's covered in other code. It really is very well defined in so many ways. And I guess the point that I'm trying to figure out here is dangerous waste versus hazardous waste. Because in dangerous waste, there are Department of Ecology provisions that they list that you have to protect it from rain and snow, and that the containers and secondary containment be inside a building or under some type of protective covering. And the containment must be large enough to contain 10% of the free liquid in all containers or 100% of the free liquid in the largest container. So like your secondary containment, if the first one fails, it's still in that containment thing. You also have your secondary containment must have capacity to hold the additional precipitation resulting from a maximum 25-year storm lasting 24 hours. So pretty rare, right? This is the regulations that they have to meet. And so my reservation only is this, is do we need to elevate it? And there becomes the risk of a tip over, or that right. Is that the right way to go? And so I'd like to get your thoughts on why elevation is that, because there wasn't this known data about the secondary containment, or is that just what you feel is best no matter what the containment is?
Well, the secondary containment is addressed in the EPA or the Department of Ecology permitting requirements, so we don't want to get involved in something that somebody else is already doing. Elevating is a very simple standard. You either have elevated it or you haven't. And so from the land use perspective, these are land use regulations that apply to new development. We're looking at when somebody goes to build some kind of new industrial facility, how are we conditioning it to ensure that it's not creating a hazard?
So what I learned was hazardous waste or dangerous waste cannot stay on site for a long period of time. So you have manufacturing things, but then you have waste product. And so we have a few companies that have waste product. That needs to be offloaded and disposed of. So would it be reasonable to think you could build a loading dock that was elevated high enough where that truck could back up to, and so we're not creating something that's unreasonable for a business to comply with? Or do you see this as something that might be hard to comply with?
I don't think we're getting into the details of, at this particular moment on the clock, it wasn't elevated. It's the larger perspective of where are you keeping it when you're storing it, where you're keeping it when you're turning it into other products. But for loading, unloading, that kind of thing, it's the regulations aren't intended to get to that level of detail.
I don't know how reasonable it is for somebody to move around constantly 55-gallon drums, but I would think that they only want to move it once or twice and then be done with it. So, Commission, any thoughts?
I just wonder if we can reference the higher power in this thing and be comfortable with that. What do you mean? I know that it's there. If it's Department of Ecology or whoever the governing body that handles all of these chemicals that we're thinking about and not thinking about, do we even need to reference that? That we're trusting that they're going to go by those guidelines before they come to us for a permit? Or
well, that's regardless of whether it's in the floodplain
yeah.
or not.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, are we adding something that's either going to be weaker or doesn't match the other governing authority?
What we've done is consistent with the model guidance from FEMA. So they've got a very simple policy statement. Storage or processing materials that are flammable, hazardous, or explosive in the identified special flood hazard area should be prohibited, period.
Bingo.
We used the language from Snoqualmie's code. We updated a little bit because they were referencing some thresholds under the Uniform Building Code. Uniform Building Code doesn't exist anymore. And we felt the thresholds weren't necessary because if you're storing or processing it, we just want to keep it at elevated regardless.
Right. So I'm okay with it as amended and with the knowledge that I now have from the Department of Ecology and our state code. Any other thoughts on that point?
The elevation is for flood line, is that it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If I can throw out just the only concern I'm thinking about that relates to this is catastrophic. That means somebody's house is floating down the river and it comes into one contact with some facility that's got these chemicals. Covered in what we're saying here for that kind of a sort of scenario?
Catastrophic is going to have a lot of other issues.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that's the degree of thought process we should be putting into having hazardous chemicals on a waterway, right?
I think the general consensus is that the best solution is dilution. So in a large event, there's enough water to dilute anything that's hazardous. Is what they said, the Department of Ecology said on their website. Yeah. So that's their mindset.
Deep horizon.
I don't think that's the best for our river. And our
I think if you just put an idea that we set the general rule not to have hazardous waste within the 500-year flood line, whatever. So they have to move those chemicals off-site if their river type businesses that they occupy some river space for their production. We shouldn't allow them to keep hazardous wastes.
The challenge with that is we have businesses that have that hazardous waste.
Yeah.
And so you would require somebody like ACE to relocate.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. There is, I think,
I see this
my old employer warehouse, we kept a lot of oils and things right there on the plant, It was stupid, but we did. And it doesn't mean you have to repeat that. I mean, there should be if you're going to deal with that, evolve into the point where you have to take that kind of material out of any flood damage because of the potential for a catastrophic event. You don't want to have to say, well, whoops. That's a different requirement on the landowner, but I think those kinds of things can't be prevented.
I guess on your sentiment, this is my research, and here's why I'm kind of at the position I am. When there's 10,000 pounds of one chemical, the federal government is monitoring that. When there's 20 or 220, I believe our state is monitoring that. And if you have hazardous or the most dangerous waste, you have someone on site 24 hours a day. So if there is an event, they're required to call and take certain actions immediately. So 90% or 99% or however much of these companies are complying with it or figuring out a way to get around reporting requirements. I'm not so concerned, I guess, with somebody not being safe, and if they are in a flood area, taking some precaution. I don't see, I don't see the paint cans being so faulty that while they're floating in the floodwater of that pond in the parking lot that they're leaking out. And if they are, then we have to work with the manufacturers of the paint cans. Now, if they have their own ammonia storage that leaked out, is their flood water sufficient to dilute the ammonia so it's not lethal to the surrounding people?
So you're saying you're comfortable with this written as it is?
Yes.
Okay. You brought the question in the first place for all of us. If you're happy now, I'm happy.
I am. So I have one other edit on page 7. Point D. Below grade crawl space foundations are allowed when all of the following conditions are met. I would like to strike will be and only if, but that's just my grammatical preference. I don't like the wills.
Let's say that again. Below grade crawl space foundations are allowed only if? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Allowed when all of the following conditions. Commissioners, any other thoughts or comments or changes? Did you say you're spent or you're
spent?
Okay. Well, I would like to know if you're ready for a motion. With no second, I will ask the commission if they're ready for the question.
Call the question.
Okay, so the motion is to approve the amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 14.12, Floodplain Management and Associated Minor Amendments to North Bend Municipal Code 14.05, Critical Areas Administration, General Provisions and Definitions, and 14.08, Streams. Is there a second?
Second.
Who was the motion?
The motion was from Commissioner Lucky.
Yeah, I'll second.
And second from Commissioner Ryan. Any final thoughts or comments? I'll say one, I just want to thank the commission as well as the staff for working with me and understanding my concern and addressing it in the edits. I think it is nice to know that other people were thinking of this, but also thinking of ways that we can do better. So thank you. With that, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. It's unanimous.
Move to adjourn.
Anything for good of the order?
One thing. And I want to, before I ask my question to the staff, I'd like to express that I've come from here, way down to here, in terms of my level of concern. I just want to ask the question. The development of the preparation for that site over there on 436. Didn't we have any tree retention responsibilities on that site?
Are you remember for the RV park?
No, for the Pulte development, the cottages in North Bend.
So I can speak to that. Yes, there is a provision in your code that requires 20% of the trees to be retained with an ability to go down to 10, I think. Mm-hmm. They met the code. They did only retain 10%. That being said, they have to replant 3-1 or pay a fee in lieu for any trees that they don't replant on site. They are going to be replanting 69 trees. So even though the large significant trees that you see did come down, they will be replanting. Again, I just want to kind of go back to, as you are doing a great job reviewing codes, these are the reasons why when you review the codes, at the time when the code was established at 20% with the ability to go down to 10, sometimes it's hard to understand what that looks like in the field. And we are right now, as you know, there is a moratorium on the cottage zone, so we'll be bringing the cottage zone back, and we are including quite a bit of tree preservation items in that.
And in the future, maybe that's another area of your code you want to reevaluate. Because, mm-hmm. you know, when you finally see what 10% is, it's not.
In general, don't we have true retention requirements on any residential property?
It's 20%.
Yeah, 20%, but it shouldn't be just 20% if that's what's going to show up. It should be 20% scattered throughout the development. They have a pocket of trees. Well, since it's in the corner of the property, it seems like it's just a gotcha.
Commissioner Ryan, in your professional forester opinion, is it better to remove the outside trees and keep the inners, or the inners and keep the outers? What's going to be safer?
For the houses or the trees?
For the people.
What our code says, our code gives priority to retaining trees in clusters so that it protects them against the windthrow.
I understand.
Well, it also does a lot of things. But, you know, at the List Light Hour, I really, you know, think getting into what it does do is it does re-evaluate every application based on the tree inventory, and we have to, you know, decide which trees are healthiest, which, based on the site plan, would be the most advantageous to save. So I'll tell you what, you have about 10 to 12 trees in the front of the subdivision. We actually worked extremely hard to move the sidewalk. Those would have been all taken out if we didn't push hard to move the sidewalk around those trees, which pushed their project, squeezed it pretty hard. There isn't provisions that tell you exactly where, you know, if a tree is on the northeast corner, you save it. So there's a lot of negotiation there. So those trees were intended to provide a softening, be at the entrance. So there is a lot of work and review that goes into that site-specific project. So
one other caveat, you may agree. Developer looks at the site, looks at the rules, buys their way out of a problem. They're going to end up with an extra lot because they flex the rule a bit. They write the check and they get $100,000 lot out of it.
Yeah.
So it's a dance.
So I guess the only thing I could think, because I've heard that comment from a lot of people, is the shock and of the tree removal. It's just simply that. You know, is there a final site plan that somebody can look at to show the trees that are put back in place? And that kind of seems to make people happy. Other than that, I have a question for staff. In our procedures, we have a requirement for officers to be elected. I would like to know if I can get a word copy to make a proposal that, since we serve a four-year term, that the Planning Commission consider every 2 or 4 years electing a chair and vice chair. And I'd like that written into our procedures and have City Council approve that.
Okay. And which is what we do right now, I'm trying to remember.
We don't have anything in our Planning Commission document that says how often. We just say to elect a chair and mm-hmm. vice chair. And I'm thinking we should have a requirement for every 4 years.
To rotate?
Yeah.
Okay, what I will say is we will put that on our list of prior things that we have to do. It can't be high priority right now.
Well, I'm saying send me the Word document, and then I can...
Well, here's the other piece I'd
say. No, what I'm saying is even getting that going, the planning, you know, the City Council sets the work plan for the city. So when the Planning Commission has a request, we run it up the chain to make sure this is in the purview. I think that's a fine comment, but I'm just going to be honest with you. Right now, we have no more bandwidth to bring forth that. And that's like, as I'm actually getting your packet out for next Thursday. So that's where I'm saying right now, I think we need to wait maybe a month, if you don't mind.
I'm not saying when. I just...
Yeah.
That's my request.
I think there's a reg in there somewhere that says if we can't figure it out, the mayor will, because we serve at his... Every one of us.
Yes.
Well, the mayor was at Rotary last week. He talked about all the people going on in this direction. I just want to quiet that as a city brain and all the staff. You guys have been worked with the friggin' ball. Everybody knows it.
I think if we were to appear at the next city council meeting and say that, we ought to get more staff. Would that help?
Yeah, they stop putting on moratoriums. We'll have the money to do it.
There you go. One more sales tax.
So just I'm going to let you guys know.
Motion to adjourn?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
Second.
All those in favor of adjourning,
sorry.
Say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Planning Commission is adjourned at 9:52.
I'm looking at two people.